This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Afghanistan is trying to get the warlords who rule most of that country to dismantle their private militias. It's part of the preparation for the country's first ever national elections. Here's Morning Edition's Renee Montaigne with the final report in our series, Democracy in the Balance.
A brief history seems in order here. Afghanistan's warlords are former mujahideen who drove out the Soviets. Then, possessing heavy weapons and private armies, they turned on each other. That brutal civil war gave many of these once heroic figures reputations for murder, looting, and rape. After the Taliban were vanquished, the warlords returned, allies of the U.S. and its coalition. Everyone in Afghanistan lived this history through 23 years of war. And on this wet and windy spring day, Afghans are fighting still, this time with kites. On a high hill overlooking Kabul, men and boys guide handmade kites, strings sharpened with resin, to cut rival kites free. Between matches, they crowd around to talk politics. A former army colonel named Faisal Haq insists elections can't possibly be fair if all the weapons haven't been taken away from the militia commanders loyal to the warlords.
Pretend I am a commander in a village, and I have got much power in my militiamen in the village. And there is someone who is highly professional and highly educated running for office. And I say to the people, if you do not vote for me, then I will kill you all, or I will punish you all. Then it is natural that people with the fear of me will vote for me rather than vote for the right qualified professional person.
Yes, I fully support the colonel's opinion.
Shah Mohammed works at the presidential palace, but he's not afraid of criticizing the president. Karzai, he says, made a big mistake in appointing warlords as cabinet ministers, governors, regional police chiefs after the Taliban fled.
First, he gave high positions to these people, these warlords, presuming he would be able to preserve peace in the country by this policy. But now they are a pain in the neck, and now Karzai does not have the power to remove them.
The ways in which the warlords and commanders within their militias can be a problem are myriad. It can be petty. Commanders in farm country outside Kabul are accused of diverting river water and then making poor farmers pay for it. It can be dangerous. Two warring warlords in the north have shootouts on a regular basis. But the biggest problem of all can be easily glimpsed by driving just beyond the city limits of the southern city of Kandahar. A local man named Mohammed Qadir points to a dry riverbed, now abloom with glorious pink flowers waving in the breeze where water once flowed.
Now there is nothing. Now they grow. Look. Do you see the flowers? It's opium.
Despite a well-publicized drive by the central government and international partners to eradicate half of Afghanistan's poppy crop, this has been the best year ever for growing the flower that has made Afghanistan the world's largest producer of opium, most of which ends up as heroin. Vikram Parakhon is the Kabul-based analyst for the think tank, the International Crisis Group. He says as warlords turn into drug lords, their private militias become even more valuable.
Right now, they can use their forces to illegally tax the population, to protect their involvement in narcotics trafficking. They can use their forces to occupy property, to win lucrative construction contracts.
President Karzai himself has said the two greatest threats to the future of democracy in Afghanistan are the drug trade and warlords bristling with weapons.
Therefore, it is necessary that we disarm and have sufficient security force from the international community to ensure that the Afghan man and woman gets to vote the person that he or she likes. Without that, our election will be a farce.
Yet Karzai's government has made only a few arrests, and those of low-level warlords. Mostly, the president prefers persuasion. A few weeks ago, President Karzai was on stage in a government ministry auditorium transformed into a sea of turbans. Commanders of private militias from around the country had heeded the government's call to come to Kabul and publicly turn in their weapons. From the audience, Ulam Rahman says he is from the eastern province of Zabul. There, the Taliban and foreign terrorists are strong, and he says his men simply cannot fully disarm. Outside, he elaborates.
I understand disarmament is important, but it's too dangerous to give up weapons with Taliban still around. We have no help, no soldiers, no police.
Risk analyst Vikram Parikhon says even in areas where the Taliban are gone, efforts to disarm Afghanistan's 100,000 militiamen are falling short.
A lot of the tanks and artillery that have been submitted by militia leaders to the disarmament program in Afghanistan have been obsolete, inoperable equipment. It's been there to demonstrate some formal compliance with the concept of disarmament, with the objectives of the international community here.
And Vikram Parikhon also blames the international coalition.
Essentially, the coalition is looking for a low-cost way to maintain counterinsurgency operations. And that, of course, means that they can't really throw themselves into a process where they will be essentially demobilizing and disempowering the commanders with whom they're cooperating. Of course, the underlying problem is that the countries that make up the coalition and the NATO member countries haven't been prepared to cough up the troops themselves.
One analyst who is busy sounding the alarm loudly is Andrew Wilder, director of the think tank Afghanistan Research and Evaluation Unit.
If you don't tackle the warlord culture of Afghanistan, you're going to end up with a warlord culture running the country. And now that combination of warlord culture combined with a drug lord culture, I think, really does threaten to take over this country. And elections could well be the tool to do that, because those combination of weapons and money are going to determine who's going to win the parliamentary elections. I think we're beginning to see that process, although it's all in the back room. So, you know, there's more rumor than fact, I think.
One big rumor this spring is that the country's most powerful warlords are banding together into a political coalition and talking about putting up their own presidential candidate. On a visit to the western city of Herat, I put the question to the man who controls the western region, Governor Ismail Khan. Yes, he says, there is a coalition, in his words, a united front of former Mujahideen.
The leaders of the United Front are still consulting. Shortly before the elections, we will announce who we are supporting for president. It could be Karzai, or it could be someone else.
At the same time, the warlord Abdul Dostum, who controls much of Afghanistan's north and the country's second-largest city, Mazar-e-Sharif, also appears to be looking for votes. Analyst Andrew Wilder.
General Dostum, they had just had a big youth conference up in Mazar where they made very public statements that we are no longer a military force, we are a political force. So General Dostum has been trying to reposition himself as a political figure rather than a military figure.
Now, is that just a front?
Well, my guess is at this point it's hedging your bets. You want one foot in the political camp in case we have a political future, but you maintain one foot in the military camp in case things revert back to the old politics of Afghanistan where things are settled by the gun.
Just to underscore the fragility of that transformation, a few weeks ago fighting broke out between General Dostum and a rival commander loyal to the central government. After Dostum's militia drove out the rival, Dostum's Youth League took to the streets and proceeded to tear down political posters urging all Afghans to sign up to vote in September's elections.
Our series, Afghanistan, Democracy in the Balance, can be heard and seen at NPR.org. There are plenty of photographs. The series was produced by Tom Bullock and mixed by Brian Jarboe. It was edited by Susan Feeney.